WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Nestled between the Sierra Nevada and the Coast Range in California, the San Joaquin Valley is perhaps the most bountiful strip of agriculture in the world. But it is also the site of one of the most bitter chapters in American history, when millions of Dust Bowl refugees streamed there in search of work, only to be subjected to some of the worst working conditions anywhere. My guest Ron Taylor has spent most of his professional life writing about contemporary migrant workers for the Los Angeles Times, and in books like The Kid Business, Sweatshops in the Sun, and Chavez and the Farm Workers. Now, Taylor continues the legacy of writers like John Steinbeck and John Dos Passos, who described the great Oki migrations of the 30s. Taylor's latest effort continues his lifelong interest in farm labor issues, but the form is different. Long Road Home is a novel. Taylor grew up on a ranch in the San Joaquin Valley and remembers the first stirrings of labor strife there. But despite highly publicized organizing efforts, the status of farm laborers has changed little, as anyone driving along Route 99 can see.
You would look out, and the first thing you would notice would be a number of cars, old cars, a number of buses, and you would see people bent over in the fields. If you stopped, get off, climb over the fence, and I'm actually thinking of, I did this once when we saw a bunch of children out in the fields. And as you know, I did a book on child labor on the farm. But you would see whole families. In this case, they were picking onions. And you would see the sacks out there. You see the people down on their knees. You would feel the heat coming up through your shoes as you're walking through the field, the sweat, the smell of the onions, and the absolute ugliness, the hurt of picking up those sacks or crawling along on your hands and knees. Degrading work done by the piece rate. Your mom and pop and five or six kids probably working on one Social Security card, one payroll account, none of them being paid enough. You know, I could go on and on. It's not a pretty sight.
And for the children who are working in the fields, how old might these be, even today in 1989?
5, 6, 7, 8 years old. I remember once I was out in the field when I was doing the child labor book, and I saw a little boy 5 and a little girl 6, and they were picking cucumbers. And they had one glove on. Characteristically, a cucumber worker has one rubber glove because cucumbers are rough, and then he carries a bucket in the other hand. And here are these little boy and little girl. So I'm photographing them. The pictures are in the book. And the farmer comes running up and says, "What are you doing? What are you doing to me?" And I said, "I'm taking a picture of you breaking the law." But I go back 2 or 3 days later, and it's still there.
John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which your book is in some ways a historical sequel to, also began as a series of newspaper articles. Was this part of the inspiration for writing a book? Was it Steinbeck that influenced you in this regard?
Well, certainly I have been influenced by Steinbeck to a great extent. I have read The Grapes of Wrath so many times I've had to buy 3 or 4 of the books. They fall apart. I use it so much. And not use it in the writing sense, but I go back to it time and again. But Steinbeck was handicapped by the fact that he was writing immediately. He was in shock. As you point out, he had come down into the valley doing a journalistic reporting job for a San Francisco newspaper. What he saw so shocked him that he decided he had to go to fiction and write about it. Steinbeck did not include any black people, any brown people. All of the farm workers, if you read The Grapes of Wrath, are the white migrant Okies. I've got 50 years looking back, 50 years of advantage over Steinbeck's view, and I know very, very well that most of the farm workers at the time the Okies came in were brown and black, and the Okies were superimposed on them. I wanted to go one step beyond Steinbeck. I wanted to do it in fiction. I wanted to add to that great work if I could.
Why did you choose to set it in 1939 rather than write a contemporary novel of farm workers in California, 1989?
Well, several reasons. First, the 1939 seemed to me, with the historic cotton strike, with the white migrants coming in, it seemed to be one of the most dramatic times that could be used in fiction. I also wanted to take a step back from what's happening immediately. I wanted to not be a reporter. And to do that, I had to distance myself. And one of the ways to distance was to go back 50 years to this very, very dramatic period.
Well, there's a scene in your novel, Long Road Home, in which your hero, young Jake Robertson, a 16-year-old boy, is working in the fields. And it gives a very fine feel, I think, of the experience that someone had there in 1939. I wonder if you could read it to it for us.
Certainly. Dirty and dripping sweat, Jake crawled slowly over the rock-hard clods, pulling up garlic plants, clipping off the roots and the tops with the A-shaped shears that the contractor sold for half a buck. Tossing the bulbs in his hamper, he inched across the field on his hands and knees, clip-clip-toss, clip-clip-toss, all the while hoping that the cooling coastal fogs would blow back in again. But the fog had long since burned off, and there was no way for anyone in the garlic field to escape the brassy sun. Working in the garlic was the meanest job in the whole damn world, and it only paid a penny a hamper, three hampers to a full gunny sack. Each evening, when they added up their wages, the seven of them were making $3, maybe $4 a day, hardly enough to fill their bellies and have enough saved up to get down the road. There was no way they could catch up on what they owed, no matter how hard they tried. So where was God now? Here, it was damn near August, and they owed nearly $70, counting the hospital bill and the house payments they'd missed.
This was the fate of Okies that you saw in 1939, trying to get by, the corporate farmers trying to maintain their estates and gambling to build even larger ones, mostly on the backs of these migrant farmers. The situation hasn't changed too much from 1939 to 1989. Did you write the novel in any way as a metaphor, an analogy?
Yes, I did. You're correct. Things have not changed that much. And I use the book as a metaphor for all of farm labor from the 1930s to the present. Workers are still living out there in hovels, in used car bodies, literally. Sometimes they even have to dig their own caves, and they're living in plastic shelters. So the conditions are as bad.
The United Farm Workers Union has been in decline for a few years. Do you attribute this to cuts from the by the Duke Majan administration in California, or to strategic errors of the union, or the lack of popular support for the union that they once had during the grape strike? What caused this decline?
All of the above. When Cesar Chavez's union won the grape contracts in the 1970s and began to win vegetable contracts just through the raw economic power of the boycott, the growers invited the Teamsters in to raid the fields, in effect, to raid the jurisdiction. And the resulting warfare between the United Farm Workers and the Teamsters, and the growers on the Teamsters' side, resulted in massive jailings. The United Farm Workers sent 3,500 of their members to jail, defying court orders. They filled the jails. That's interesting that in my book I use that scene, and that's actually where this comes from, this tactic of filling the jails so you can't arrest anymore. But out of that confrontation, that violence, that turbulence, the farmers decided they wanted a law. So for the first time in the legislature in California, they passed the Agriculture Labor Relations Act. That's the first time farm labor has ever been included in the law. Okay, after Jerry Brown was the then governor, Democrat, liberal, and appoints pro-worker members to the Agriculture Labor Relations Board. When Governor Duke Majan is elected, he appoints pro-farmer members to the board. He cuts the budget so that the laws are not enforced. The Agriculture Labor Commissioner's office staffing was cut, so they don't enforce labor contracting laws. The ALRB's staffing was cut. So with the coming of this conservative Republican administration, the laws are not enforced, the union begins to lose its power. Chavez also had internal problems in his union. Some of the older, more aggressive members of his union were literally thrown out or quit. There was a lot of dissension, much of which has never really been aired publicly. But the union, as a result, has withdrawn. It runs an economic boycott through a computerized mailing system. It doesn't have organizers in the field. Chavez says he can't get any results because the laws are not being enforced. But for whatever reason, the UFW's presence is not out there in the fields anymore. So the union has lost the power, lost the contracts, sits in its mountain retreat up there, mailing out copies of The Wrath of Grapes, the electronic media campaign to raise money to boycott grapes.
You make up a county where these events take place in your book, between Fresno and Tulare counties. Did this give you a sense of power as a novelist to sort of create a world that didn't exist before, help you break out of that bondage of being a journalist, restricted by just the facts?
Well, yes, a sense of power, I guess, yeah, true. But at the same time, it gave me a freedom. It's a liberating experience to take all the facts that I know as a reporter and then to fashion them into fiction, create a county, create human beings, create these kinds of situations that are really truly happenings, and bring to it a larger truth. It sounds corny, but in journalism, you cannot get to the truth as quickly, as finely, as sharply as you can in fiction.
It's kind of an astonishing paradox that you can reach truth through fiction rather than fact, then.
Well, absolutely, because you take the role of the journalist. If I go to that garlic field, all I can do is walk in the field. I can describe what we've described here, but I can't, in the newspaper, tell you what's inside of Jake's head. I can't give you the history, the emotions, the feelings that go up to make Jake Robertson a vital human being whose whole life is being shaped by the circumstances around him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.